One. Welcome back to Hoops HD, everybody. It is Monday, June 2nd.
No, it isn't.
That means it's time for our May podcast, Griggs.
It is May the 33rd.
May the 33rd. Yes, something like that. I'm your host, Chad Sherwood, here at Hoops HD. We've got John Titel and David Griggs up top here with me. Down below, got Joby Fortson, and joining us from Bracketeer.org is Rocco Miller. And we'll have a little off-season discussion here because last time I checked, there weren't any games played in the last week or so, Griggs, unless I missed something.
No basketball anyway, but yeah, plenty happening off the court, mainly what isn't happening. We'll get into all of that.
Yes, and the main topic we wanted to kind of discuss here tonight was something we talked about a lot, I think, during the regular season and said, gee, we're going to have to do a whole show on this off-season. Well, here we are. It's off season. It's time to do that whole show on it. And it is pretty much the state of where college basketball and where all college athletics is right now with the combination of the NIL money, the portal, the transfer portal, the pretty much unlimited transfers that players get. The fact that players look like they're now going to get 7 or 8 years of eligibility. We don't even know what's going on with some of these eligibility rules going beyond four seasons. The house settlement that is still in the works, but could have the schools directly paying the players. And I guess there's several questions here.
Yeah.
Number one is this good for the game? If so, why? If not, why not? And on top of that, you know, if it's not good, how do we fix it? Is there a fix? Or is the proverbial, is it out of the bag? Is it too late? Sorry, Griggs, you were saying something.
Well, I was just kind of agreeing with you. We probably should have thought a little bit about how to get started tonight, but very briefly, the history of this, it actually goes back to the Alston case, and you could even back it up further than that to the O'Bannon case. The issue was for years, the NCAA and college athletics had amateurism, which basically meant that you, at the Division I level anyway, you could get a scholarship, which would pay your expenses, but that's all you could get. That's all. And so whether you were the star player for the top-ranked team or out of the rotation for the lowest-level MEAC or SWAC team, you were getting the same. As television contracts grew, as athletic department budgets bloated out, a lot of people felt that that wasn't fair. They ended up taking the NCAA to court various times for name, image, and likenesses, saying that it violated antitrust laws. Before that could even play out, a lot of state legislators started passing laws saying that players had basically a right to their name, image, and likeness. So that rule changed, and it was basically, very basically, just one antitrust suit after another that attacked the transfer rules, the NIL, and now I think we're starting to see, as you alluded to, Chad, the eligibility rules are also coming into play. The House case was basically back payment, back payment for players that were not allowed to make money but should have legally been allowed to make money. That bill is coming to somewhere around $1 billion that the D1 membership is going to split over the years. And part of the settlement, they hope, is going to be parameters for future athletes, namely limitations on NIL. But as you know, if you've been following the news, the state of Tennessee, and I want to say, was it Wisconsin? I could be mistaken, but a few state legislatures are already passing laws saying that that their schools within the states don't have to abide by the parameters of the House case. This is Matthew House, who has nothing to do with the case anymore.
Yeah, well, see, that's a whole other level that we got to get through, get a settlement approved before we even see how that all plays out. But
yeah.
Rocco, let me kind of start with you here. Is this whole system imploding, or is there actually, maybe there's an argument that some of this is actually good and some of this is needed?
Yeah, I mean, it's got so many layers to it, right? So there are examples of that. And then there's, of course, examples of it never going to be the same as what we came in new to love in our generation. So it's just really kind of how you want to approach it. We have to deal with, you know, the future and the reality. And, you know, they're basically righting quite a few wrongs from the past, where the whole idea of amateurism, as we've done a great job, I think, over the years on Hoops HD, have talked very bluntly about, just in terms of players and what the value of college basketball is. We have basically a $10 billion tournament, one of the most valuable postseason events in any sport globally, not just in college sports. So obviously players are a big part of that, and without them, and there's value to that. If you're a college kid, you can make a living doing anything in any career except for sports until just recently. So trying to right all those wrongs is not easy, and there's so many layers to it. So as it pertains to what we've just seen in the last 2 years, which is a dramatic change from what you were able to achieve as a under the radar program with continuity and really some value added by just staying at places like, we saw that amazing Florida Atlantic roster just 2 years ago. That seems pretty much impossible now in 2025, in 2 short years, just due to the fact that, the value of players and the money going around has ballooned even in just a year. Right now, the going rate in the transfer portal, if you're an all-conference player in the top 10 leagues, is north of $2 million if you're still in college. So just a year ago, people made a big story out of Great Osabor getting 2 million, and he's only one guy. So now that's just all become normal. So everything's changing dramatically. Then you have bigger layers to it with football and with things like the SEC threatening to leave NCAA altogether. What would that do for everybody if we had a scenario like that? So there's just so many different layers. And I think the last one I think that's really fascinating is we saw 137 players, Chad, that had no eligibility left, enter the portal anyway, and just file what's called a TRO, which is a temporary restraining order. I know you and legal know this. And if they get that approved by November, there's not going to be anybody there to overturn it, and they'll all get to play next year. So everybody from Ante Brozovic from Charleston to a bunch of guys, Malik Thomas actually already got approved his waiver. He'll go to Joby's Virginia Cavaliers, a terrific player from right here in San Francisco. We also have the JUCO ruling with Diego Pavia and Vanderbilt's quarterback, allowing guys like Chad Baker-Mazzara to stay in college and go to USC next year. Tyon Grant Foster started college basketball in 2018-19. He'll play for Gonzaga next year now because of the Pavia ruling and others. So there's a lot to talk about, but it's getting impacted in a variety of ways, and it has already become the has and the has-nots of college sports and what league you belong to.
And getting to build off that, and I'm about like I need to rope our legal experts in, but essentially the issue is antitrust law and price fixing. So it would be illegal for a group of competitors, in this case colleges, but we'll say it was fast food restaurants, KFC, McDonald's, Hardee's, Wendy's. They all got together and they had an agreed upon maximum wage. Like, in order to keep our costs down, let's all agree to not pay our workers more than a certain amount. That would be illegal. That's essentially what the courts are saying that colleges were doing with athletics. So that is the basis of it. You can't have any sort of salary cap without an agreement from labor. And in this case, the players,
Yeah,
and you,
without collective bargaining,
yeah, without
but like you
collective.
have in professional sports.
Yeah. So why are they winning these lawsuits? Well, because there is no collective bargain. The courts are saying, well, you can't make those rules. And with transfers, well, you can't tell players they can't transfer. That there's no bargain in place. And with eligibility, like the thing that Rocco just pointed out, one of the reasons that they're getting these restraining orders, they're like, well, hey, wait a minute. Like, who is the NCAA to tell schools who they can and can't employ and put on their teams? Like, that's an overreach. Very basically, that's what's going on. And from a legal point, I know we got to get you and Ty Tell the way on. And as much as I'm in court, it's never as a lawyer.
Well, Tytel, what do you think about the
And
whole legal?
Joby's also here.
Yeah,
Sorry.
well, okay. Well, I'll throw to Tytel first, then we'll go to Joby. But Tytel, I think that there is something to that though. That basically these kids have, for all these years, have been bringing tons of money to the schools. These TV contracts are insane these days for these colleges. Hadn't been making any of the money from it. Hadn't been able to even sell their name, image, and likeness. And now the schools want to put some type of cap on it, but that is, isn't that a collective, isn't that a antitrust violation to try to do that?
Sounds like, But as I'm not a antitrust nor employment lawyer, I'm going to pass on that one and just focus on NIL at the moment. So the settlement does contain reporting requirements, which requires schools to send details of the payments and the agreements with NIL collectives to the NCAA or to make them public. Significant back pay, $2.77 billion, and we're talking almost 400 athletes who competed from 2016 to 2024 and did not get NIL money. The reason that caught my eye is because I don't know why they picked 2016 specifically, but you look at a guy like Tyler Hawes, he scored over 2,700 points at BYU, but since he did so pre-2016, I believe he gets zero of that multi-billion dollar package himself. And then there's also a new NIL clearinghouse that reviews these third-party deals that exceed $600, which I assume a lot of them do, just to ensure they meet fair market value. And no, I have no idea what that means in this context. And they have to stay below the established salary cap as well.
I'm just I don't know for certain why 2016 is a cutoff. It could have actually have to do with literally with statutes of limitations on bringing those types of claims. That versus when the lawsuit was actually filed. But putting that aside, Joby, your take on this whole thing here also, and all this money that is now out there, and I've said that we are akin to a situation here where if this was a pro sport, if this was the NBA. Everybody's a free agent at the end of the year, can go anywhere they want for whatever, with no salary cap into what they can get paid.
And that's the I've been and people who watch this podcast know this. I have been a strong advocate for NIL for a very long time. I am not as strong an advocate on a salary. It's because it's I look at it from fair market. NIL, if you're a superstar, someone will pay you money to, come, whereas, people aren't paying those the million-dollar contracts are not TV contracts are not because of the third string point guard. So I like NIL because there's a market element to where it's a performance, it's kind of a performance enhanced thing. I think the solution that could happen is one that I have been wanting to happen by force, but I think the market might come and intervene on it. And that is, you're exactly right, Chad. At the end of every year, everybody's a free agent. And under the law, the best I read it, and that like Tytel, I'm not an antitrust lawyer, that's the way the law should read. There's no collective bargaining agreement. There's no, why should you be able to restrain trade, so to speak, on receiving NIL or where you do your practice your trade. I hate the amount of portal and transfers. I wish there was a way to limit, but I get the legal reasoning and the reason for it. So what's the solution? I actually think the solution is what should have been the solution a long time ago, which is I hated the fact that kids were obligated for 4 years, but schools were only obligated for one in the simplest of terms. I hated the uneven nature of that. Your scholarship in the days when we talk scholarships, your compensation, your scholarship, et cetera, should have been guaranteed, barring criminality or, not show up to class, et cetera, barring other factors, all factors being equal, you shouldn't have been able to run off. I think now schools might have to find themselves in positions to offer contracts that are multi-year, that and guaranteed money if you stay the second year, and there it's going to be the market that doesn't. And there'll be kids who say, "Yeah, I want the security of $2 million a year over 4 years." Not just the one-time payment. I want the train. That's why in the NBA, long-term contracts are the player what players want. Is more than the teams. Don't think, oh, this only helps the schools if they do it that way. So I actually think longer term contracts will slowly but surely become a thing and become actually the norm within like 5 years. Right now we're just living in a weird resortment stage where it's 1 year contracts, but what's to say you can't sign a kid for 4 years? But guess what? That money's guaranteed, most likely, depending on how the contract works, et cetera. So you guess wrong if all of a sudden the kid that if you sign a kid for multi years and he turns out to be a big bust, well, That's your scouting department's problem, not the kid's problem. Or the kid's turns out that he just wants to sit on the money. Stephon Marbury, a la Stephon Marbury. Sorry, but that's going to be I think a solution that helps with this. But I don't. The bottom line is, I really the unionization. I think it's so awkward to squeeze that square peg in right now. It's going to be tough. Even though I know grad students unionize, and so I think it's going to be tough. And then you get into private colleges versus public, and it turns into a whole mess.
Yeah, I love the contract analogy here. Most of us in our jobs are at-will employees. That means that we can quit or be fired at any time and go find another job the next day. And that's how it is with college basketball players, pretty much right now. Where they're not, we're not they still haven't quite reached the stage where we're technically calling them employees, but we all know that that's pretty much where it is. But a contract lets you, if you are an employee that has a contract, you've got a contract that says you will have a job for X number of years, you will have to do the job for X number of years, and you can't go. They normally have a non-compete. You can't go and work somewhere else that's our direct competitor during those X number of years. Well, if these kids coming in out of high school are signing 4 or 5 year non-compete contracts, they're guaranteed the money, but now they got to stay at the school. There goes all the transferring, unless maybe we'll start seeing some 2 year contracts instead of four. Who knows? But I love the answer that contracts may be the solution. Griggs, I know you had some comment on this, and I think that once we get to contracts, we get to collective bargaining as well. I think it all goes hand in hand, but go
I
ahead.
think so too, and it's interesting. And it, I don't know if you could word the contract in a way, because a lot of the under the radar schools, and particularly the lower level conference under the radar schools that don't have any revenue to share, could they work up a contract to where if a player does transfer that they get, I don't know what a fair percentage of it would be, 5%, 10%. So if someone does get the
Whatever you
$2
want in a
million.
contract, why not?
In world soccer, and that's a great point, David. Great point. I am
Yeah,
actually
like what
saying
World
world
Soccer
soccer
does.
is
I didn't
getting
want to make Chad's
unbearable
head
today.
explode, but that was what I was going after.
I think that's a great point.
Chad, you asked the question, is it good for athletics or not? And I'm kind of going to give a little bit of a statement slash answer of what I think about that and kind of open it up to you guys. Without getting into too much detail, prior to the FBI raids in particular, there were schools that had access to agents and apparel companies and money to pay under the table, and those that didn't. And there were a lot of what's an etiquette, an eloquent way to say that there were a lot of dickheads around basketball, but there were a lot of dickheads floating around, and I thought that they were, I thought that they were basically steering kids to make decisions that weren't in their best interest. And there was this small window between the time of the FBI raids and the end of the Alston case where it felt like there was this level playing field. And if you were an under the radar school, you could get access to players that you suddenly couldn't get access to before. And we saw Florida Atlantic and these teams, San Diego State, build rosters that went on deep Final Four runs. The year of COVID, all these teams were in the top 10. It was Creighton, Dayton, Florida State, Gonzaga. I mean, I think six of the top 10 were either outside the Power Four or a program like Florida State that, while in a power conference, was not a basketball blue blood. And it was beautiful for such a short amount of time. And while I'm glad that the dickheads aren't as impressionable and as powerful as they used to be, I'm also not a fan of the sport being now. You don't get to build that continuity. It used to be you got a lot of satisfaction if you worked in college athletics or were around a team of being around a kid that came in as a freshman, left as either a junior or a senior, signed a pro contract probably somewhere over the seas, was making, $70,000, $80,000. I mean, you don't get that anymore. The pitch is instead of come here and earn your degree and then be positioned to continue playing if you want to, it's come here for 8 months and then maybe get some money to go sit on someone's bench. Anyway, your all's thoughts on
Rocco.
that? Yeah, I mean, that's what it is. I mean, when you're the, we talk about it a lot in scheduling these last couple months. It's like you could have an awesome SoCon team, Conference USA team, even Missouri Valley team. But when your best player can make more money by being the 10th best player on a Big Ten or an SEC team or even a Big 12 team now, it's really front loaded the top of the sport in these rosters. And that trajectory started over the last couple of off seasons, and now it's fully in place to the point where, I it's impossible to expect a team from under the radar to be consistent enough. I mean, basically every advantage you could ever imagine at this point is working against them, whether it's in scheduling, can't even get the games they want. The MTE Foundation has, basically crumbled through the Players Era event. And then that will ultimately probably be voted out in the end of this month, is when I believe
32,
the vote will happen. And so you have that element of the sport. Then you have the competitive element of the sport where, even if you do bring five guys back, like teams like Yale have been able to do, the Ivy's actually been able to improve because they're one of the only leagues where continuity means something due to education. You still are completely out-athleticized by all these bigger supreme conferences. So, the chances of a team like Louisiana Tech going out and finding, a bunch of great JUCO players, or it could get, getting a crack at a couple four-star freshmen, putting some talent and athleticism on the floor. Sure, they can do that, but can they go out and beat a group of, the teams like that Auburn and Florida and Duke and Kentucky are building are full of 21 to 23-year-olds with backups with those types of same talent, if not better. So you're basically having to play a perfect 40 minutes to even be competitive. And even that's probably still not enough. So we saw a lot of that last season, and I think that's only gonna double down next year in a lot of ways.
Yeah, Tytel, let me bring you in here also. Is this, do you think this is bad for the game here that we are now limiting the best teams to just the teams that can play, that can have these great rosters? And we'll see maybe the major conference teams like SEC and Big Ten teams with rosters full of older players making tons of money. They add four or six more spots to the NCAA tournament, so there's even less of a chance for a Cinderella story, more of these giant rosters full of, $20 million rosters, out there. Is that where we're going? The thing is the way we're going. How bad is that for the
I think
game?
we're there.
Yeah.
We might be. I mean, it seems like after Charlie Baker said last week that talks are underway with CBS and Warner Brothers Discovery, that there is going to be an expansion to 72 or 76 in the year or years ahead. If they get it finalized this summer, it could happen next spring. But when you think about it, if you add four more teams, then you just have to televise four more games, which is a lot, but is really like a day or two, not the end of the world. And this is revolutionary in that, like, it's been a minute since we had an expansion. The last one was back in 2011 when we went from 65 to 68. And Baker specifically looked at last year's 2024, I should say, last year's Indiana State team. They won 28 games in the regular season, lost to Drake in the MVC tourney title game by 4 points, and missed the tournament. And if you think about it, if we had 72 teams last March, I mean, you wonder who's going to fill in those last four spots. I think it might have been a bunch of mediocre Big Ten teams, frankly. If you look at Indiana, this is a team that announced in early February that Mike Woodson was stepping down.
West Virginia.
You got Ohio State, who lost 15 games, and you got Nebraska, who didn't even qualify for the freaking conference tournament.
But I guess here we'd go to the Indiana State example, but if we throw in all the money here, are we ever going to see another roster like Indiana State at that level of school? Or all we're going to do by adding four or six more teams is put four or six more $20 million rosters into the tournament?
The latter.
Right.
Yeah, in the other thing, I understand the thought process of, well, if we had expansion, it would be more fair to the Indiana States of the world. Drake, I forget where they were on the seed list. I can't remember if they were inside the first four or not, but it's very plausible they would not have been selected without the auto bid. I think that what needs fixing is the regular season. I don't know how it can be done, but it's just if the committee's evaluating the value of your profile and you can't get the games on your schedule that make your profile valuable, that's what needs fixing, not expanding the tournament.
Right, but I think let's. But how about fixing the larger picture here, though? Joby, you threw some slices out there. Rocco, how do we fix this NIL transfer portal free agency thing? Or should we just let it happen?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know the right solution. I think, one way it could go is that these top three or four leagues, especially if another power league gets gobbled in and it becomes three, which obviously is going to be more driven from football than anything, but we could end up with that. If they go off and form their own association and play by their own rules, then do we do it? We keep an NCAA tournament with the other 29 leagues or 28 leagues. I guess we'll be back at 29. I mean, that's possible, but the popularity would obviously be completely crushed with all those big schools gone. And then you talk about a relegation type of model. I mean, it just, yeah, for college basketball, I think the most important thing to do is, if you do expand it, like Tytel said, it's pretty easy to fill in the TV slots. But I also think, Joby and others over the years, we've talked about one of the most important captivating elements of the tournament is your coworker who doesn't watch college basketball ever until maybe that last week before March Madness. They go to the printer every year, even though printers should be probably outlawed from offices, but they still have them at a lot of places. They print out their bracket, they ask you a bunch of questions, they get all excited and they fill it out, even though they know nothing about the teams. And they filled it out because you, I, John, and Joby are experts compared to them. And they get all excited and they turn on the, and then the, Thursday starts, they turn on the games, they're fired up just like we are. That's literally like probably over 50% of the viewers up
Way
until,
over.
yeah. And so they have to keep that element of the tournament to be able to have a clean bracket to where people are going to fill it out. And if the field gets so big to where, there's too many playing games, or you can't even fit all the teams on the sheet, that kind of thing. I think it's really going to be a huge step backwards just from the amount of attention this event gets.
Well, in terms of the breakaway, Joby, I've always thought that if there is some type of breakaway, it might be limited to football only, which it would hopefully, at least our sport, basketball, might be protected from that because you can't. I just can't see all the sports breaking away, and you've got the rowing teams breaking away, and the archery squad, and the bowling team, and all that.
And you can do it much easier in football for the mere fact that you already had back in the day the NCAA and the CFA. Remember that? You had that, break. Yes, it's a Big Ten Pac-10 because of the Rose Bowl and all this stuff, but it's not like we haven't been down this road before on that. I do question whether men's basketball and women's basketball come along for the ride, though. I you're right on rowing. You're right on, track and field and some of the others that don't, the non-revs. And you're probably also, but do you see men's basketball because people are going to be looking with dollars in their signs in their eyes? And if you do it for men's, you're going to do it for women's. Just
Yes.
know that.
I
They go as a pair.
well, the women's game, the way it's been the
And
last
the
few
way,
years,
yeah.
is
Yeah.
it's wow.
By the way,
True.
the highest rated it from 2024, the highest NCAA sports related thing, the highest was the Rose Bowl between Texas and Michigan. Second was Caitlin Clark in South Carolina. So it was like, or LSU, rather.
Well,
So,
the women's game has units now.
yeah.
It used to be that the men's tournament was all of it. But to kind of go off of what you said, present company excluded, Rocco touched on an interesting point, and it's something that we've pointed out before, is that the NCAA tournament transcends basketball more than any other event transcends a sport, minus maybe the Kentucky Derby transcending horse races. It gets a lot of attention from people that know nothing about horse racing or Olympic gymnastics and track and field. People that don't know those sports get into the Olympic. I mean,
Swimming,
yeah,
yeah.
swimming, college basketball's NCAA tournament does that. The thing is, I don't think it, I know that this is cynical, but it's the truth. People that work in athletics and make it their life, and that are submerged in it 24 hours a day, don't understand that. they don't make the distinction that this is appealing to people that it normally doesn't appeal to, and they just think that like they're so rock solid awesome that they're the reason it's a big deal, and if they do split it off, it'll remain just as popular as it is now, and it absolutely categorically will not.
Yeah, I think, well, I think,
Go ahead.
yeah, I mean, I actually think there's a way bigger influence now. And I agree with you on the college athletics employee standpoint, but there's a huge influence from TV executives. I'm actually convinced that in the committee room, when they make decisions for matchups and all of that, TV executives are in there. We
They're
kind of
not.
cracked it,
The
or they're not in there,
staffers are
but.
in there. The staffers are in there, but
Yeah,
yeah.
but there's definitely a huge TV element to making this a built for TV event. Whether or not the matchups kind of write themselves, they're pretty much all good anyway. You can tweak a couple like they did with Kansas, Arkansas in the first round on the first primetime slot there Friday night. But yeah, I think TV has such a huge influence on everywhere college sports goes at this point. They control pretty much all of college football, and with the biggest parts of college basketball, they have a huge influence. So I would be personally, I'd be surprised if they kind of didn't see that coming, where the expansion would have this kind of backfire element to it.
You're right at Rocco. It would take the TV partners, though, to step up and say so. And the question is, do the TV partners fully get it? I mean, I'm not
They
100%
should.
sure.
Some
Well,
of them do. Some of
some
them
of them,
absolutely do.
and TV partners,
They
I might
should.
add, are changing because, the partners we talk about are TNT and CBS. No. It's going to be the partners of the future are Netflix, Amazon, it might be,
Apple.
if it might not be CBS, it might be Paramount Plus, sort of.
Tytel, I don't think I really got your answer to this question yet. I think you're more of a purist like I am. Like you love the old way things were with true amateurism. We're not getting back to that. I think we could all agree to that. Do you see any solution to where we're going, to where we go from here?
Maybe. I think it would have to be legal. And so I know we talked a little bit about the state legislature. So some have already passed laws saying that their schools do not have to abide by any settlement, which could lead to some potential conflicts. There's at least 17 states with laws on the books preventing the NCAA from restricting the student athlete's ability to get money from an NIL collective. And there's also some states with laws that just allow schools to pay the athletes directly. The NCAA has been lobbying for federal legislation to codify terms of the settlement. And as Chad can tell us, what happens when you have a new federal law and an existing state law that are in conflict?
Well, you probably end up with a lawsuit is what you actually end up with, and throw out there that there is a presidential commission now to try to figure out this whole thing that is.
Congress is not going to pass a law. Let's just be very honest. Congress is very good at not doing it.
Yeah, the NCAA
Not
is
going to happen.
pushing hard for this.
Yeah,
So
it's not happening.
I think it's wishful thinking, but they're thinking it
Yeah,
in.
I mean, and here's the thing is you got to remember, and not to get too political, but you're going to be in a situation where you need 60 votes through the Senate. And whenever this issue, one side's going to be screaming for collective bargaining, the other will be adamantly opposed to collective bargaining. Guess what? Stalemate, done, no bill. It's not happening. I mean, just it's not.
Griggs, have we covered the subject? Is there any other aspect of this? You kind of called this meeting here, so let me throw it to
Yeah,
you if that's what we did.
something that we talked about it already, although we didn't mention it, but I think the next thing that's going to come under fire in these rapid fire lawsuits and maybe even getting to the state level is eligibility. The issue of can you, it used to be you had to be in good academic standing. You actually had to meet academic checkpoints. I won't get into all the things, but you had to meet academic checkpoints as far as progress towards degree and your GPA, and you could play 4 seasons in 5 years. And now we see 6, 7, 8 years down the road, kids are still playing. Are we getting to a point to where eligibility goes out the window? And if that happens, could it be that we see guys on teams that aren't students at all at the school? They're playing their eighth or ninth year at their seventh different school, and they haven't been inside a classroom in 7 years.
And hey, let them just keep playing. Let these kids,
Yeah.
don't be kids anymore. Let these men now play till they're
Yeah.
35, 40, can't play anymore, right?
And I have an
Not
issue with
back yet.
that. Because I think it takes an opportunity away from a so-called traditional college student that enters as a freshman or sophomore, going up against somebody that is of a professional skill level, and they just won't have a chance to ever play unless they're in the Ivy League.
Well, Joby, wouldn't it help if we had some type of organization that oversaw everything and made the rules? We could maybe call it the NCAA.
Yeah.
I mean, well, and here's the thing is, we've said this before, and I won't repeat what we've all said before. The biggest problem the NCAA had in this process was BAM bureaucracy that didn't think there was an issue.
Yeah.
And that's why when we talk about, oh, well, the TV guys realize it's an issue, well, the conference guys realize it, I worry about that because the NCAA, by the nature of this darn thing, the NCAA thought everything was rosy, and oh, they're never going to lose. And they've been spiked in court, as we all know, every time. I mean, who are their lawyers? Now, I'm not saying because they l argued the case poorly, but it's because they didn't advise their client wisely.
Or their client didn't listen.
And their client may have not listened. And that is a very strong possibility. But NCAA is an easy whipping boy, but just because it's an easy whipping boy doesn't mean that it shouldn't be a whipping boy. A lot of the problems do rest with them and their inaction. They could have gotten ahead of this. They really could have. They could have had settlements long before House. Long they could have done this, but they when you have in life, I can handle someone who is arrogant but very good because. Okay, they're irritating, but you know what? They're at least accomplishing their job. I can handle someone who's ignorant because at least they're willing to learn and improve. Arrogant ignorance is the worst capability you have because you have no humble. You're not humble, and you'll remain incompetent for the entire extent of whatever length of time you want to measure.
I guess on that note, let me run through each of you for any other final thoughts you have on anything we discussed tonight or any other topics you may want to bring up here. We just saw Murray State knock out Ole Miss in the college
Yeah.
baseball tournament. Congrats to the Racers onto the Super Regionals. And have a Little Rock up 5-1 as we record this in the second inning. But Tytel, let me start with you.
Amidst all of the new rule changes and settlements and realignment and portal, the one that caught my eye the other day was SEC Commissioner Greg Sankey on Thursday announcing a new fine for rushing the court. It used to be escalating. 100 grand, 250 grand, 500 grand. Now we're just go right to the top. 500 grand the first time. The X factor is if you let the opponents and the refs get to the locker room first, then the conference can waive the fine. Do I think it'll stop? I don't know, because if you're an 18-year-old kid who's watched your team upset a great SEC team, then I assume you want to get on that court on national TV and go nuts. But if the penalty is $500,000, I wonder if the schools will institute some sort of police presence, for lack of a better word, because it's worth $500,000 to not let them jump on the court immediately.
Well, I'll tell you what Tytel, there was another part of that actually where it says that the SEC will allow, without penalty, court rushing as long as you give the other team time to fully leave the court. So all they got to do is hold it back for about a minute
Yeah,
before they
good
rush,
luck.
which you're normally still on the TV broadcast for that minute also. So hopefully we this works because my thoughts on court rushing are well known here.
Yeah.
Joby, let me go to you.
Get off my lawn, as Chad would say. No, I like cord rushing as long as it doesn't lead to awfulness. And that's tough to manage. So, okay, SEC, trying to do a good job. All right. So, I thought it'd be fun to look at some of the preseason stuff, the way too early lists, and that sort of thing. And something popped out at me. So, I looked at Joe Lunardi's bracketology. Not to give a plug to Lunardi, but it gives you an idea. That, and I was shocked when I saw that the play-in game is on the 10 seed. And then I started breaking it down and I realized only six conferences were inside the AQ that were inside the at-large bubble. Only six. Gonzaga was the only team that would be from a bid steal conference. The other ones, you can name the other five. Even Memphis was outside the bubble. By the way, in the J&J preseason, which the first run is ready, Memphis is inside the bubble by one spot. And so I totally get this. But this goes directly to the conversation we're having here, which is the power conferences now don't even have to worry about bid stealing. Who cares if Drake loses, and they're because they weren't inside the bubble to begin with. It's going to be very interesting to see how this develops. And it shows exactly the conversation we've had today, which is the rich are getting richer, the powerful are getting more powerful. They're getting, you don't have, you don't have Broome at Morehead State, for instance, coming back. He's at Auburn now. And so, these sort of situations are only going to increase. Anyone worth their salt is going to find their way to a Power Five because the money's there. And I don't know if that will change. It might even add to the upsets from an AQ, coming along. But unfortunately, I don't think the Indiana States are going to get the opportunity because, sorry, in our little example, Indiana will have the horses to be able to get whether there's 68 bids or 72. It's going to be, I think, even with that, for the most part, five conferences are going to be represented. Six, maybe when the Pac-12 merges.
It's kind of funny. We've always kind of had three levels of conferences when we do our shows throughout the season. The top power conferences, the under the radar conferences. We kind of had this middle group of the American, the A-10, the Mountain
Yeah,
West,
we
this
call them the
mid-level,
multi-bid
the
leagues, like
multi
not
bid
power.
leagues, whatever. I think you're right, Joey. Those conferences are just going to drop into under the radar as well because they're going to be single bid leagues every year, the way things
I
are
mean,
going here.
there's no preseason team. Usually we have a few. There's no preseason team out there that people are going, oh, remember Buffalo, remember Wofford, remember. We knew these teams were going to be good. They don't exist anymore, except for the exception that is Gonzaga, who will be joining the Pac-12 in a year.
Rocco.
Yeah, no, that's awesome because Joby took a lot of where I was going with the overall point, but I was actually going to reference not to give another source extra credit here, but Torvik puts out a basic projection for 2026. It's all free for everybody to look at. And honestly, all 31 leagues, I talk to them on a daily basis. Not every league every day, but obviously over the last 2 months I have. It's used very often as a common ground in scheduling. So it's like, oh, you're projected, as low as 325. We're looking for 350. That's how the Power Conference teams schedule these days. But my overall point is, if you just take the top 60 on here, and again, there's some missing data, there's some missing players. This gets a little sharper as the offseason continues, as more commitments come in and people alert him on different teams. He's definitely the strongest on the top, which is all that we really care about for forecasting the NCAAs. And out of the top 60 teams, there's only five that don't belong to the Power Five. And it's kind of concerning because even Gonzaga themselves is all the way down at 24. They're barely even a top 25 roster right now, is what that really is saying. San Diego State at 41. Again, their season's going to go one of two ways based on the health of Magoon Gwath and the surgery he recently had. If he's healthy, I think they are going to be tournament level good. If not, really hard to say. VCU is brand new with Martelli at 45. And then Boise State and St. Mary's in the low 50s. After that, like the best team is not Memphis. It's actually South Florida and all the talent that Brian Hodgson brought in, but even them at 62. So everybody in the top 60, outside of five teams, is a Power Five school. So, and like I said earlier, with the scheduling challenges, the fact that Power Fives, when they go to do home and homes, when they go to do neutral site games, when they go to construct MTEs, basically all the old ways where under the radar teams, or even what I call mid-major plus teams, which are those next, like you guys say, the multi-bid leagues traditionally, try to schedule them, there's even fewer opportunities than before. So not only are the rosters being manipulated, schedules even deeper manipulated, and now the committee might have some difficult decisions because if a team like South Florida can't get any Power Five teams to play them, but they win, let's just say they go 16-4 in a pretty good American League. Like, obviously, the leagues like the A10, the American, the Mountain West, and the WCC are still about the same budget in spending. So their rosters have about the same ceiling and floor, minus Gonzaga and Memphis being a little bit higher, and Dayton. You're going to be having some tough decisions there where they'll have no real data to look at. And so that will be fascinating to see if a couple can squeak in that way. But otherwise, you guys are right. There might not be a such thing as a bid steal unless there's like five Big East bids and the seven seed in the Big East wins the Big East tournament. Otherwise, it would just be a ton of one bid leagues.
And with 72 teams, that seventh place team was already in. Probably.
You're probably looking
I'm
more
actually
of.
worried about the Big East too, because out of the Power Five, they definitely have, the least backing compared to the other four financially.
It's gonna be unless DePaul wins the Big East tournament. There's no bid steal.
There you go. Let's get DePaul.
Griggs, you want to finish the show out?
Yeah, I don't want to mope about too much about decisions that were made in the past, but I still think that when the Alston case came out and the Supreme Court ruled 9-0 against the NCAA and basically instructed them in a concurring opinion, I believe it was Brett Kavanaugh, that they needed to collectively bargain with the players. Had they done that at that time, they could have, while SAC, the Student Athlete Activities Council, is part of the NCAA, it is structured in a way to where every team at every school has a rep, then every school has a rep that goes to the conference, every conference has a rep that goes to the NCAA. They could have made that the representative body for the students and negotiated favorable and fair terms and gotten students, the players, more, which I think that they deserve. I mean, I thought that they deserved more than nothing, which was what they were getting. It was kind of outrageous when the marching band would be getting paid, but the players were not. But they could have put caps on, they could have made concessions and put caps on transfer rules. They could have made concessions and allowed NIL, but with limits. And I think it would have given the players more, but also kept a sort of competitive balance, which, for that very short time, it felt like we were really starting to enjoy. And, but we're past that now, and you kind of wonder, kind of like what everybody else is, are those days gone forever? Are you just, if you're not in one of the Power Four conferences, are you just going through the motions and then hoping to get your one bid and trips to deepen the tournament? It starts to become like, top level European soccer, to where, with the exception of about eight or nine teams, you'll never see anyone win the Champions League. And I don't think that's good for the sport. I don't think it's good for the players. And for the most part. And I also wonder, like, if eligibility goes away, that certainly isn't good for the traditional student if guys that have been playing for 7 and 8 years can continue to play and not get out of the way and give somebody else a chance. I don't know. I wish I had answers. I wish I had ideas, but I don't. I do think one of the things that we do need to point out, because it was true, as far as the popularity of the sport, the ratings for this year's NCAA tournament were outstanding compared to recent years. I think the round of 64 and 32 got what the highest rating in, was it 21 years? It was a very long time. And if you go back and look at those games, a lot of them were garbage. It was not big upsets or thrilling games, but yet the popularity of the sport from the people that are just sort of fair weather fans or March Madness fans, but not college basketball fans, is healthier than ever. So I don't know. I don't know. Maybe the sports just passed me by.
Oh, does that mean we get rid of you next season?
It might, yeah.
On that note, I do want to thank you for joining us. It's going to be interesting over the next couple of years how this whole thing plays out because, while I think it's right that the kids are finally getting a share in the money, the system might make is on course to crash, I think. And I hope that maybe some of the ideas we threw out here, maybe some of the ideas we've seen out there in the media and in various, hearings that might be happening or whatever, maybe somewhere there is a solution. I hope we get it because it is a great sport. It's a great tournament, and we don't want to see it lose that. We're watching in baseball right now, as I mentioned earlier, Murray State onto the Super
Yeah.
Regionals. Little Rock, who had a losing record and was one of the worst teams in a bad conference all season, is on the verge of knocking out of going on to the Super Regionals
I
in
think their
baseball as
RPI was like in the 260s or 270s. It is the
Yes.
craziest run I can ever remember in any sport.
And while baseball is a lot different sport, a different animal than basketball and football, but basketball we discussed, we don't want to lose that magic that we're seeing right now in the baseball tournament out of the basketball tournament. So
Right.
hopefully we don't. But on behalf of John Tytel, David Griggs, Joby Fortson, and Rocco Miller, check him out at bracketeer.org. I'm Chad Sherwood. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back later on this month for our actual June podcast. Talk to you then.